Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from: a curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Here today with Shintaro Okamoto, and I've long and from afar been a fan of your work. And, you know, it falls kind of at the edge of the culinary landscape. It is ice carving.
Right.
It is ice sculpture. I don't want to call it carving if you think of it as something larger, as something more artistic.
I'm embracing all terminologies.
But I don't even remember the first time I saw one of your sculptures. And prior to that, you know, being in college, you kind of relegate ice things to luges. Right. But to see it not only as beautiful as it was, but it also be a serving vessel, it be a device for cold smoking, it be that much more, made me rethink frozen water as a whole.
Right.
So I know you grew up in Japan until, you know, like 9, but when you moved to Alaska, you were surrounded, I'm assuming, by ice. When did this fascination start with you?
Oh, gosh. I spent my formative teen years in Anchorage, Alaska. Not all Alaskans played with ice, but I did. give a bad rap to all fellow Alaskans. And we're not surrounded by icebergs and glaciers and all that. I mean, we are if you look up in the mountains or choose to hike up to it. Town-wise, it's kind of quintessential, probably like close to a Midwestern town or anything. They got everything, you know, there. But my encounter with ice came from my father. My father was a trained sushi chef. And it was a business opportunity that, you know, that took the family to Alaska in the early 80s. But during that training period, he came across ice carving as one of the elective craft in the process. And he was always a very artistic, creative, hands-on person. He was always making sculptures and painting in his own time in his younger years. And he really kind of, I remember him telling me that they asked him if he's ever done this before, and he kind of lied and said, yeah, sure, and kind of gave him an upper level, you know, trial, and he carved an eagle or something. And he really enjoyed the process, loved the tools. He was always a tools man, so he bought the whole range of tools. But when we, you know, immigrated to Alaska, he kind of put that away for a couple of years to just kind of settle down and situate and focus on the business. And then I remember one boring cold winter, he took, you know, myself and my brother to a frozen lake nearby pull out a chainsaw, cut out a hole, took a tong and pulled it out, almost fell in, and then carved a swan and I gave it to a friend for a birthday party, and then everybody loved it, and then somebody else wanted it, and you know, next thing we knew, he was kind of running a side business and also kind of, you know, got embraced into kind of this really small subculture of community of ice carvers that came from all over the world and gathered for competitions and exhibitions. And it was still very much an early ages of ice carvings, and tools were taken off the shelf from Home Depot and modified. And, you know, my father was again, he was a great tinkerer. So he really kind of helped develop and I think pioneered, a great drive for an ice sculpting community in the States.
But was it the chainsaw or the swan that really got you into it? Because I feel like seeing a tool like that at a young age is formative as well.
If anything, I have to say my appreciation for all this came much, much, much later for me, because my background is in painting. I make paintings, and I had a great artistic life from early on. But I was very much more of a 2D person growing up, if anything. So I just remember the early years as just being cold and not having fun, being wet, and being there more of a familial duty to just, you know, accompany Dad and help him out.
Yeah. I mean, do you go to school for something like this? Or was this something when you were at the dinner table, everyone had to carve their own ice?
No. there's no school really for it, you know. Ice sculpting is fascinating that the process itself is almost identical to wood or stone. The tools are very similar. I think the major difference is the speed, the sheer speed. If you have the sharp tools and if you have the right tools, what you can accomplish and achieve in scale and details is immensely fast.
But like you said before, you're converting something that's 2D to 3D, mm-hmm. and that takes a specific mind. Is it something that you have to learn CAD for, or specific design elements, or is it just being an artist that you're able to envision this?
Well, I mean, I'm sure if there is a school and if you choose to go to, I mean, it, you know, like anything, it's really a matter of doing. You know, you put in your hours and you put in the experience, and you learn from really doing it one after another. So, I mean, that said, you know, most of our sculptors are painters, actually, and mainly because of what we do in our studio, we carve such a wide range of things, from, you know, replicas of products to animals like kangaroos or a Porsche or a logo or a portrait, an architecture. We do such wide range of things. I learned early on that you carve as well as you draw. So, I mean, if you can understand visually the frontal view and the side view and top view, back view, all that, understand that in a flat, you know, dimension, and you just need to tie all that together, and you have a 3D form.
Yeah, but you're starting from this blank slate, this giant block of ice.
Yeah.
And I've seen videos of these machines that create these large pieces of ice, and you know, they bubble from the bottom, they, you know, have the cooling underneath there, so it's this beautiful uniform, no bubbled, not cloudy, palette. Where do you start? Like, how do you actually, what is your first cut
when we're sculpting something? We make giant sculptures that stand, you know, over 20 feet tall to small singular plates, for chefs and, you know, gatherings. And no matter what, everything starts pretty much with a chainsaw, you know, no matter how big, no matter how small. I would say about 60-70% of the work is done by electric chainsaws. And if you're doing large pieces, I mean, single unit block, that's kind of industry standard block size, is about 40 inches by 20 inches by one sized, about 9 inches. You know, it's about 275 pounds, about 40 gallons of water. And, you know, when that comes out from a machine, again, it's an industry standard machine called the Kleinbell machine that makes crystal clear ice. You know, the top surface is kind of irregular from the process of freezing. So we kind of run it through a bandsaw so that it's a nice and flat surfaces. We have, if we have large blocks that requires multiple blocks to be stacked, you know, we kind of block out the design to understand what size of these stacks and fuse lines need to be. And then we literally fuse them. And kind of create this kind of pixelized version of whatever we're sculpting. And then we hit the town with all the tools.
So this crystal clear ice, also known as dead clear ice, you know,
that's how we call
it. Yeah, but it can't be accomplished in a freezer because it was really interesting to learn that, you know, freezer, the bubbles kind of get pulled into the center.
Right.
Whereas this, what is it, Klein Bell machine,
right.
They get pushed to the surface and right. out. So you have to start with a great quality, you know, ice product before you even start carving.
Right. You know, the ice that we use, I've always been marveled by the quality of ice that we use to sculpt our work. And you know, that clarity equals density of the ice itself. So it's very strong and slower melting ice. And that was very critical to creating sculptures. And you know, that really comes from the way the machine makes these ice, and essentially it's two important elements that really makes this block, which is one, a unidirection freezing, which has a coolant in a bottom, so it freezes bottom up. And two, it's the agitation of the water. By moving the water as it freezes, it releases any kind of still air bubbles and impurities on the surface of the ice at all times. And it takes time, you know, it takes about 4 days per cycle, and each machine makes two blocks. So, you know, a lot of the ice carving studios will have numbers of these machines to kind of, you know, meet up the demands and all that. And we hoist them up when they're done, and you know, we go from there. But, you know, I mean, knowing that we had this beautiful, perfect block of ice for carving was always something that was on my mind. I think that then became a natural extension out to thinking about, you know, how else is ice utilized in our world.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, come back and talk about luges, bottle chillers, ice bars, and cocktail ice. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market believes in seeking out local, fresh, and seasonal food and in supporting local farmers, makers, and the community as a whole, economically and agriculturally. Whole Foods Market believes in food that is vivid and colorful, fresh and full of nutrients, food that connects you to your body, the seasons, and to nature, food that helps you do more, sleep better, and wake up happier. Found in over 400 locations throughout the United States, Whole Foods Market only sells food that meets their standards, which means no artificial colors, flavors, preservatives, or sweeteners, ever. Whole Foods Market believes in real food. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more.
Welcome back to heritageradionetwork.org. You're listening to The Food Scene, and I'm here today with Shintaro Okamoto, and we were talking a little bit about, you know, getting the perfect ice, but there's a bag of tools here, and hopefully not a chainsaw, but there are other kind of like fine sculpting tools that you use to craft these perfect pieces of ice. So what are they and what's in your bag right now?
Well, today, you know, I thought it would be nice to kind of play a little bit, or just at least to show. So, I mean, I brought, you know, we do all these sculptures for a wide range of events, fashion shows, film premieres, product launches, weddings, bar mitzvahs here and there. But we also have a very, you know, robust cocktail ice program where we service and cater great, beautiful, you know, select bars in the city. And you know, that I brought some, to, you know, some ice to kind of show and maybe make some sound or something.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But you know, I have
let's do this.
Should I just open this?
Yeah, absolutely. And which bars do you work with exclusively, or is there a large range?
I mean, we work with ranges. I mean, we work with PDTs to Momofuku, you know, Little Branch, Rain's Law Room to, you know, hotels and venues. And the list is constantly growing. And, you know, I mean, I think what sets us apart is really not just the ice itself, but, you know, how we maintain them, how we deliver them, you know, from eight, from the beginning to the end, that sense of beauty and perfection and ease of use is very, very critical. It's one thing to just receive an ice, but it's another thing to be able to understand what it is to maintain these things so that, you know, it stays optimal at all times.
So are you on site like a pit crew with little tools to be making sure that it's at its best, at its peak temperature and its peak performance?
Well, I mean, I often do, you know, go to venues and see how they're storing it and how they're utilizing it, and, you know, often consult and what better ways to you know use ice and we get their glasswares and, you know, recommend what best sizes there should be. I mean, essentially what we want to do is, because our ice is so beautiful and clear, you know, we want to give that one singular ice cube that fits beautifully into the glassware. You know, larger the ice, the least amount of surface area, but it also has the core temperature that it can maintain itself. Ice is an incredible insulator of its own. So, you know, the larger ice, larger and singular the ice, the longer it can maintain its temperature. And the clarity of the ice, I mean, you know, the bartenders and these beautiful liqueurs have incredible colors that they work with. But if you use conventional cloudy white ice, you lose all that. So, you know, when people use our ice, it's really kind of point of no return. I mean, you really experience it and people be like, what is this? And it's a completely different experience. And, you know, that's how we get them.
Yeah. I was going to make a joke like, once you go block as an ice block, you never go back. But, oh, I guess I made it because it is on air. But yeah, let's see what kind of tools you have in this bag. Because I'm always fascinated. I worked in Boston as a photographer and cook for years, and there was a place called Drink, Barbara Lynch's bar. But it was so amazing because they get this large block of ice delivered each day. They were trained in how to carve it down into rods and then into cubes.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we certainly do that too. I mean, we provide some of the establishment wants to cut in their own ways, and they have their certain sizes. And you know, cutting is in front of the clients is, you know, one of the, you know, I think showmanship and part of performance as well. So we give larger pieces of block of ice for opportunities like that too.
I mean, the clarity is amazing. This is absurd. I mean, you do see some of the cut marks, but I've also seen you use things like, what is it, aluminum? Some kind of metal surface to be able to smooth the edges.
Yeah, I mean, for cocktail ice purposes, it's really... It's really more about precisions of cuts. So it's, you know, it's hand cut and machine cut in a way that you know, works. And, you know, there's a mass production that goes in there and the process and protocols that we go through. But, you know, we use, I mean, household irons and aluminum plates. And mainly we use those to prepare the fuse of the blocks to create perfect, you know, flat surfaces where two ice can come together, and we splash some, you know, ice cold water and it really freezes together.
So it's like the transglutaminate, the meat glue of ice is just water.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Excellent. And what is in that case? I know you're rearing to open that up as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so I mean, I have a 2-inch cube here, which is probably the most popular cube size that fits well into rocks glass. And I also have a kind of skinnier, taller ice that we call either a Cullen Spears or a Highball Spears. This is the kind of little show and tell of my tools. I carry this small, you know, tools about the size of a letter size paper that's got four different kind of hand tools that I always carry around when I troubleshoot in installations, or, you know, when I go to bars and make little shapes for presentations. This is a dear friend of my father and really one of the most amazing, you know, carvers in the world, Junichi Nakamura. It's a Japanese ice sculptor up in Hokkaido. But during his off seasons, he makes tools. He has this beautiful, he makes these incredible tools with handles made out of Japanese elk handles. And it's just so wonderful to just hold and be around. So this thing is always, you know, kind of attached to my body at all times. But, you know, I mean, you know, we have the three-prong chippers here. And I have a flat chisel here. This is great when I can take the corners off. I use these often to, you know, shape the cubes into kind of a jewel shaped block, a small ice pick that we have, and a little handsaw here that can kind of create any kind of curvatures and things like that. So with this, I can pretty much troubleshoot anything that happens out there.
You know, it's that is an artist palette. I mean, that seeing those tools alone and seeing how cared for they are and how ornate the handles are, this makes me believe, you know, that ice sculpture is art. You know, I think you say on your website that it is this thing that melts away, eventually disappears. It's one of a kind, but it also stands for this kind of clean luxury, this very modern thing that can be customized. And so as much as it is, you're producing this piece of art, you're producing artwork every time you make a sculpture, every time you make a cube.
Yeah, I mean, essentially it is that one time, and it is, you know, something made just for you, and no two are the same. So you know, I think it's humbling on our part, you know, in the process of making these things. And, you know, we're trying to give a little bit of ourselves, and you know, it's a very under-investigated, underappreciated, and fascinating material that we get to work with every day.
And I love that it's from your hands too, because my favorite thing about going to Japan or going to a Japanese, you know, restaurant that serves sushi and omakase is that you see the sushi master put the rice and the fish in hand and move it about and then hands it to you, like literally hands it to you. And yeah, that's how you take it. And it is that receiving something so temporal that's the magic in it.
Yeah.
And I feel like you guys deliver these sculptures in the same fashion.
Yeah, I mean, I think the spirit is very much similar. And, you know, it's, I mean, for us, as you know, in our studio, everybody's a practicing artist of their own different trades. And you know, in our studio, we get to kind of flex our creative muscles to work with ice. But we have the whole process side. But then once we set up the sculptures or you know, see in cocktails, it's that reaction, the immediate reactions that we get to see that's always, in you know, surprising and fascinating.
So next time you see an ice luge or a raw bar or caviar and vodka service in a large ice sculpture, you know, think about where that ice came from and the people behind it that crafted it, and check out okamotostudionyc.com. And if you hear chainsaws in Queens, it quite possibly might be Shintaro carving the next beautiful swan. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Music by Cookies and David Tadashore Engineering. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.